My name is Megan. I'm alcoholic. I grew up in AA. Both my parents are in the program. I'm lucky that way because I got to see that this program actually works, and it is a miracle. I was always really comfortable here as a little kid. I always felt safe and comfortable in the rooms. So when I hit my bottom, I wasn't afraid to come in the rooms. And also because I had seen my mom go from death's door, suicidal, shock treatments, all that, to the woman that she is today, I knew that it worked. And I knew that even though I didn't get it right away in 2009 when I first came in, I kept coming back until I did get it, until the miracles started to happen. And that's through a lot of prayer of people around me, a lot of love that I felt in the rooms. I didn't love myself. I hated myself when I got in here, and a lot that has changed a lot. I ended up wake up call. I ended up in jail, and I kind of knew everybody when I went in there. You know, everybody from OBT and stuff. So that was kind of a sign for me. And then when I was in AA meeting in jail, I was reading from the book, and they were saying how your life had become unmanageable or something, and I just started bawling, crying when I was reading. And the lady's like, "Oh, why are you crying?" I was like, "I'm in jail. Like, I never saw this for myself, you know." So anyway, but it took me to a lot of places I didn't think I'd ever go, and I'm glad that I woke up. And I'm glad that I made it to the room because my next step was definitely death. So thank you for letting me chair. It keeps me sober. So let's see where we at. Okay, so the speaker tonight, his name's Kent. And I got sober on the east side of town, Avalon Park, and over there. They have some really, really great great sobriety over there, and a lot of the guys, they love me until I could love myself, Kent included. So, sorry. So I'm really glad that they're here, and I don't know, this program is amazing. So I'm really grateful to these guys, but Kent's one of them. So Kent, coming up.
Hi everyone, I'm an alcoholic. My name is Kent Peterson. I'm going to just put this over here on the side. My sobriety date is April Fool's Day, 1992. I decided I didn't want to be a fool anymore, and so that day was very appropriate. I want to thank Megan for inviting me. You never know how these things turn out, but you know, it's always exciting to be asked, and then when you get up here, it's like, why did I do this? So, in any event, hopefully I'll be able to present what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. One of the things, couple premises before I start. If I go too long in my drunkalogue, one of the things that I hate in speaker meetings is that people go on for about 50, 55 minutes with what it was like and then never what happened or what it's like now. So I'm going to try and divide it up equally into different stages of my alcoholism and also my sobriety. I originally am from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, which I euphemistically call the pit of the nation.
Nice.
I grew up with two parents who were both alcoholic. I would say that my family was probably upper middle class. My father was an executive with Alcoa Aluminum. And we had a beautiful home and a fully stocked bar in our basement with a pool table, and my father loved to entertain. Problem was that my father was gone probably 6 months out of the year, traveling, building bauxite plants around the world, and had the opportunities to provide a lot of revenue for Alcoa, and to a degree a good salary for himself. And so I was not for want as a child, but my mother, who also was an alcoholic, used to go to coffee klatches and bridge parties and social events, and when I came home from school and she had been out, I never knew kind of what condition she was going to be in. And so it was always this sense that I had to be the perfect kid and not get into trouble. Well, I was far from that. I have had two brothers. I'm the middle of the two. My older brother was born with cerebral palsy and was 3 years older than I. My younger brother was 5 years younger than me and was the one who had the charm and the charisma and was basically the apple of my parents' eyes. Growing up, as I say, we had basically whatever we wanted. Our house was the clubhouse of the on the street, and I just enjoyed having the attention, having friends around, having basically whatever it was that I wanted, and so life was good. I did pretty well in school. My parents really pushed education and felt that it was very important. Both parents did go to college and were well educated. My older brother had a lot of difficulties in school because of his cerebral palsy, and so it was always a matter of let Kent do it. You know, he couldn't necessarily do a lot of things because of coordination and some of his disabilities, and so it was usually my responsibility to have to cut the lawn or the chores around the house. And again, because my father was gone 6 months out of the year, I was basically the man of the house, and I learned to be very responsible at a very young age. But I also remember some insane things that I used to do. There was a time where my father built this unbelievable model railroad display in our basement with lighted trees and houses and three or four trains with it, and told me that I couldn't touch it. Well, I was pretty pissed, so I pulled the whole thing apart one night. You know, it's again, I wanted what I wanted when I wanted it. And so my direction towards addictions and having a desire for basically whatever I wanted started at a very young age. I remember at a party, I was probably 11 or 12 years old, and we, as I said, always had alcohol in the house. We were having friends over, and my father was mixing Tom Collins's, and I was to take him out to a guest, and I ended up taking him out and drinking him myself with a few friends, you know, and I thought it was just hopped up lemonade. You know, I didn't know there was alcohol. You know, I didn't even know quite what alcohol was. But it sure made me feel good, and I certainly enjoyed the effect that I got from drinking. We had wine at meals. We had champagne for celebrations. We had a keg on tap, as I say, in the basement at the bar. And so if I ever wanted any alcohol, it was there. The problem was that as a kid, I was never happy being a kid. I always wanted to be grown up. I wanted to be able to do the things that my parents could do. And so I thought by being an adult or being a man, and because, you know, I had all these responsibilities because my father was gone, I started smoking cigarettes at the age of 11 or 12, started drinking beer, probably 12 or 13. We used to go to the Jersey Shore a lot during the summers, and a place called Ocean Grove, and I had the pleasure of being up at a wedding about a month ago, and we went down to the Jersey Shore, and the remnants of Sandy are still very evident. The boardwalk is gone, the pier is gone. Fortunately, they didn't have a lot of damage to the homes in Ocean Grove, but there's what's called the Great Auditorium, which holds about 10,000 people, and it's actually a Methodist community, and they get ministers and preachers from all over the country to come and speak during the summer. And we had a tent that they put up from Memorial Day to Labor Day. It's probably about 12 by 12 with an adjoining cabin and then a bathroom in the back with a little kitchen area. And every summer I used to spend in Ocean Grove. Well, if any of you are from up north, you may remember the commercial for Schaefer Beer. Schaefer is the one beer to have when you're having more than one, you know. And so that was my beer, you know. I had to have more than one. And so we would get a friend of ours, older brother who was 18, and back then you could drink. You could get alcohol at the age 18. It was back in the just before Vietnam and that type of thing. So we would have him go get a six-pack or 12-pack or whatever, and we would sit under the boardwalk, either in Asbury or Ocean Grove, and just get loaded. And my aunts were kind of our caretakers during the summers, and I used to go to the shore with my cousins. And so we'd come home drunk, and she'd just wonder why we were so happy and having such a good time. And she was an older aunt who really didn't quite know what was going on, and we would just kind of separate ourselves. And it must have been the birch beer we were drinking, you know, not the real stuff. But I have a lot of fond memories of Ocean Grove and my summers up in New Jersey. I went off. One of the things that I've also learned in life is that sometimes tragedies are our opportunity to change our lives and to give us an opportunity to better ourselves. And as difficult as those tragedies may be, we have a choice. We can let it destroy us or we can let it better us. And so in 1966, oh, that's another thing. I hate it when people have to kind of figure out how old I am and dates and that kind of thing. I was born in 1951, November 17th of 1951. And so in 1966, the spring of 66, I was 15 at the time. I was in Pittsburgh with a couple friends, and we were in our backyard. And we were making fireworks, getting ready for the 4th of July in April. And, you know, we had, you know, the caps, and we'd scrape off all the little gunpowder or whatever, and, you know, it was just never good enough. And that was part of life, you know. It was never good enough. You know, it had to be better, had to be bigger, whatever. So one of my friends decided to add some gasoline. And he had a bucket of gasoline, plastic bucket, and another friend lit it. And, you know, there was flames everywhere, and the bucket started to melt. And he threw it. And I was right in front of him. And I was just completely on fire. And all I can say is, you know, I'm glad to have remembered stop, drop, and roll. Because I rolled in the grass, and, you know, my clothes were just completely charred. All I can say is thank God for underwear. Otherwise, my child probably wouldn't be here today. But I remember walking into the house and thinking, I need to cool off. And so I started a cold bath. And my mother, she was actually preparing for a trip to Europe with my father, and saw me, and she just freaked out and said, you know, we're going to the hospital. And so I went to the hospital, and I had second and third degree burns from basically my waist down to my knees, and I was in the hospital for 6-7 weeks. And had whirlpool baths and gauze treatments with vitamin E and the whole deal, and it was pretty painful. But I was in the pediatrics ward of the hospital at the time, and I loved being with these other kids. You know, there was this one kid who had a car door close on his head, and he must have had 150 stitches. There was another kid that slid down a slide, and his mother wasn't there to catch him, and he broke both legs. And, you know, after you're there for a little while, you kind of know the routine. And so they gave me a wheelchair, and I'm doing wheelies up and down the corridor of the hospital. And, you know, they bring you your pear juice and whatever else it is that you want or need. And but at that time, it gave me a desire and an interest to be a physician. And I really wanted to be a pediatrician at the time, because I loved being with these kids. And so that was kind of my quest in life. And I recovered pretty well. I still have scars on my legs, but no permanent damage. Fortunately, I didn't have to have skin grafts or anything like that. But shortly thereafter, my mother ended up taking her trip to Europe, and when she came back, actually, while I was still in the hospital, she and my father had decided that they were going to get a divorce. And my mother just couldn't handle being in Pittsburgh by herself, raising us boys. And so when they came back, they got a legal separation. And my mother moved to Mexico City, and my father took a position in São Paulo, Brazil. And I went off to private school in central Pennsylvania, to a prep school called Mercersburg. And it was a pretty traumatic period of time, but again, education was very important, and I loved being in central Pennsylvania. The school that I was at was an all-boys prep school, and so actually when I finished school and came down here to Florida to go to college at Stetson, I was pretty socially retarded because I didn't have much experience dating girls or being with girls, and having come from a family of two boys, there just wasn't that much of an opportunity. So while I was in prep school, we'd always get townies to go and buy us beer. We had access. One of my roommates my senior year was probably the biggest drug dealer, and in respect to AA, I'm just going to refer to those as outside issues, but bottom line is there were a lot of outside issues that I used while I was in high school and then in college. Whenever we could get it, we would get it, and I would drink it. You know, it's like, okay, you know, what are we going to do this weekend, you know, to have fun? So let me move on. I had that opportunity. It was in 1970 that I graduated from high school. The draft had just come out, and I was on the waiting list at the University of New Hampshire, University of Vermont. I was very much into skiing and winter sports, and I was on the waiting list, and when the lottery came out, my number was 6. So it was either get into a school or go off to Vietnam. And so fortunately I applied at Stetson and Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas, got accepted at both. and decided I've never been to Florida, so let's see what Florida's like. So I came down here, moved my mother from Mexico City to Fort Lauderdale, and went off to college. Had a great time in college, joined a fraternity. I do not regret my college days. Because of my experience in prep school, I did very well in college. I started out in pre-med, again with that desire to be a doctor. And after my freshman year, I had to take a class in quantitative analysis in chemistry. And I said, I'm never going to get through this. And I couldn't understand, what does chemistry have to do with medicine anyway? So, I don't know, I must have been on too many drugs that day, whatever. So I switched my major to psychology. And everything transferred, all my credits and that type of thing. During college, as I say, I had a great time. I still stay in touch with a lot of my fraternity brothers and just had a really good time. Moved after I graduated with my degree. I went down to Fort Lauderdale and started working in a school, working with kids with emotional problems and learning disabilities. And loved that and did really well for that period of time. Had the summers off. The summer of 1976, my brother and I, my younger brother, Kirk, and I went up to New England for the bicentennial, the tall ships, we were at the Esplanade in Boston for Arthur Fiedler and the Boston Pops for the 76 July 4th celebration, and it was wild. Went up through Montreal to the Olympics that summer, came back to Fort Lauderdale. 2 weeks later, my brother, Kirk, was down in the Keys, dove into a pool, and broke his neck. He was a C1, C2 quadriplegic, similar to Christopher Reeves. He was down at Jackson Memorial during that period of time, and actually lived for 18 months. It was a difficult time for us as a family. My father decided to take early retirement, had a heart attack, but moved to Miami because the doctors felt that it was good that somebody in the Dade area was paying taxes and was a resident of that area to justify all the expenses. My father started drinking a fifth quart of vodka every day. You know, here's a man who could build $60, $70 million bauxite plants, but he couldn't fix his youngest son's broken neck. And my father virtually drank himself to death and died 6 weeks before my brother did in April of 1978. I took off, went out west. Again, my drinking got to an extreme. Came back to Florida, met the woman that I was to get married to just before I left, Linda, who was the love of my life. I was going to open my own school at that point out in Colorado and go back and get my doctorate degree in education. But I came back, and Linda and I started dating. I was working on a corporate-owned sailboat at the time down in the Keys. It was kind of an interim job. And back in those days, corporations could write everything off, and so it was a 41-foot Morgan sloop, and our job was to provide breakfast and lunch to the guests and have the bar stocked with whatever liquors they wanted. And I've never seen so much Chivas Regal drunk in my life, and I probably drank half of it myself. Again, a lot of outside issues during that period of time. I had a very short courtship with Linda and convinced her that I was the guy for her, and we ended up getting married 6 months later in November of 1979. Had a great honeymoon, went on a cruise down in the Caribbean. I'm serenading her on the docks of St. Thomas, convincing her what a wonderful life we're going to have as I'm falling down drunk. And we went on a moonlight cruise. There was a rum punch, and the captain goes, if you want a little added boost to this, there's some 151. You know, you got to have a little 151. So I fell down, ripped my new suit. It was quite a scene. She didn't know what she was in for, and, you know, I thought I could handle it. You know, it wasn't that bad. That was always the situation. So in 83, my son, Colin, was born, and that was when I gave up cigarettes, because I didn't think it was good to be smoking around him. Although I'd sit out on the back porch and smoke a bong, and at the age of four, he'd come out and go, Dad, can I have some of that? And I'm going, no, I guess this isn't too cool. So I gave up that and some of the other powdery substances that were around. And, yeah, you know, you got to enjoy life. That was my father's motto. You work hard, you play hard. And part of playing was smoking, drinking, whatever. So let me move ahead to period of time where as to what happened. In 1991, through a number of circumstances, I went back and got my master's degree in applied psychology. But I did a lot of work in pain management and biofeedback. And I went to work with a group of neurosurgeons in Fort Lauderdale at Northridge Hospital, and had that opportunity and experience to be in the medical setting, which is what I always wanted, you know. And so it was just in a different adjunct profession. I got a position in the psychology department of Pinecrest Rehab Hospital in Delray Beach. And I was there for 11 years and really loved it. I was there with a group of physical therapists, occupational therapists, physiatrists, and, you know, dealing with individuals with chronic pain, stroke, head injury, spinal cord injuries. So my experience with my brother really was helpful during that period of time. But there were three events in 1991 that really kind of changed my life. One, on my son's 8th birthday, he said to me, Dad, why do you have to drink? It's a tough question to answer to an 8-year-old. You know, well, you work hard, you play hard, you know. It's just giving the old routine answers. But, you know, I realized that it was becoming a problem. The second incident happened. I was going to pick him up at Fort Lauderdale Children's Theater, and a cop stopped me. I had an open beer. He stopped me for speeding. Came up to the car, never saw the open can of beer, thank God. Gave me my speeding ticket, and I thanked him, and I went on my way. You know, again, wake-up calls. We all, you know, have to wake up sometime. But the most significant event was I was working with a patient in the hospital. I walked into her room, and she had rods coming out of her hips and down her legs, and her name's Tracy. And Tracy had been out with her best friend for lunch, and they split a bottle of wine. And after lunch, she proceeded to drive her new car into a tree, and her best friend was killed. And here she is charged with DUI manslaughter. And, you know, here I'm counseling her, and then I'm going home and drinking a 6-pack or, you know, 12-pack on the weekends. It just doesn't make sense. But, you know, it was also a period of time where, you know, I needed to get that buzz on faster. So I used to drink vodka and Gatorade. Now I guess it's vodka and Red Bull or something else, you know. But it was like I had to get that buzz. And so I started going to Al-Anon because I was still dealing with my mother in Fort Lauderdale. And the beauty of Al-Anon is that you can go and point the finger and still drink as much as you want. You know, blame everybody else for the problems in your life, and that's what I did. Well, after a binge weekend, I decided I needed to change rooms, and so I went to the Islanders group on Las Olas in the hospital, and I said, my name's Kent, I think I have a problem with alcohol. And I was so afraid to admit that I was an alcoholic, because my image of the alcoholic was the guy living under the bridge, eating out of a dumpster, you know, just the bum on the street. And, you know, I couldn't be an alcoholic because I had a beautiful home in Fort Lauderdale, two cars in the garage, probably making more money than I've ever made in my life, beautiful wife, beautiful son, and having to admit that I was an alcoholic. But I started going to some different meetings. I went to the Fort Lauderdale men's group, and there were a number of men there that... you know, would talk about how many DUIs they had, how many cars they had wrecked, jobs lost, wives left, you know, being homeless, penniless, whatever the case may be. And again, there was one guy who was even talking about bleeding from every orifice of his body because of his drinking. And I'm going, well, I can't be an alcoholic. You know, and then I'm going, well, maybe I'm not even a man, you know? I mean, if this is what you got to do to be part of this group. So bottom line was I ended up going to the Imperial Point Beginners Group, and that ultimately was my home group. And there was a judge there, Judge Paul Moran, who I always say gave me my spiritual awakening. Unfortunately, he was never through the court system, but he was a member of the program, and unfortunately, Judge Paul is in the big meeting in the sky right now. But I love Paul, and he said to me, Kent, not everything you hear in a meeting are you going to agree with, but if you can get something out of it, just keep coming back. You know, we're not going to kick you out of here. You know, just if this helps you, just keep coming. So if there's anybody here doubting whether they're an alcoholic, just keep coming back. And so I was going to that meeting, and the first year of sobriety, actually it was August, shortly after my son's birthday of 91, that I started going to meetings. And as I say, I didn't get sober until April 1st of 92. And I told my wife, well, I'm going to AA, but I'm not going to quit drinking. You know, the insanity. And, you know, and she goes, okay, that's fine. Just keep going. And over time, you know, people were happy. People were having a good life. And I wanted to be part of that. And so in March of 92, I was having dental surgery, and they put me on some antibiotics. And they said, you can't drink while you're on these. And I said, okay, well, you know, let me see if I can, you know, manage to stay sober for a few days anyway. So I picked up that white chip, and it wasn't even at my home group. It was at a Methodist church meeting on a Tuesday. And I don't recommend this for anybody, but they asked if anybody wanted a white chip. I could not go up and get it. But they said, if you're shy, we'll leave it here. And I went up and I picked it up. And that was my one and only white chip. And I am so grateful. You know, I've not had to use any mood-altering substance, drink any alcohol of any kind since that time. And my life has never been better. But I heard a lot of crazy things in AA my first year. And I'll share a few of them with you. One, it's the first drink that gets you drunk. No, it's the seventh, eighth, ninth. I didn't quite understand that. Other people would say you have to give it away in order to get it. What does that mean? You know, don't change anything in your first year. But then somebody else would say, you've got to change everything. You know, so I was confused. Then they'd say, think, think, think. And then they'd say, don't think and go to meetings. You know, I mean, we got a phrase, we got a hook for everybody in this room. Simple program for complicated people. Egomaniacs with inferiority complexes. Don't think less of yourself, but think of yourself less. Carry the message, not the mess. Don't leave before the miracle happens. Now, I always thought that that was the hook, you know, and when is my miracle going to happen? You know, it's like, okay, I'm sober a week or two, you know. You know, I want instant sobriety. You know, you're right where you're supposed to be. Learn from the past. Don't live in the past. Surrender to win. There's no reverse in the hearse. People in the back are sitting in the shoe department. That's where the slippers, sneakers, and loafers are. People would always say they're off to someday aisle. Someday I'll do this. Someday I'll do that. So, amen. And then people would come up with different letters and abbreviations, acronyms in this program. You know, people who are in the CIA, they're Catholic Irish alcoholics. You know, God, good orderly direction, gift of despair, group of drunks, SOS, stuck on stupid, denial, don't even know I am lying, kiss, keep it simple, stupid, faith, Father always in thy hands, bitch, babe in total control of herself, sober, son of a bitch, everything's real. IBM, itty bitty miracles. How? Honesty, openness, willingness. Halt, hungry, angry, lonely, tired. You know, I've learned a lot in this program, but there are a lot of things that, you know, I hear that, you know, we're just one alcoholic trying to help another. And if we can pass on the message and give it to others the way we've learned it, and I want AA to stay the way I learned it, because I learned from old-timers. It took me a few months to get a sponsor. John Kay is my sponsor in Fort Lauderdale. We moved up here in 2009. And Mike A. is my sponsor here in Orlando, but I still talk to John on a weekly basis, and I talk to Mike probably a couple times a week. I go to four or five meetings on a weekly basis. I like going out to Bar None, and there are a couple guys here from Bar None, and I thank you for your support. The East Orange Step Group is very important on Thursday nights at 7. And I go to Eastside probably three or four times a week, usually 5:30 on Mondays and then noon Wednesdays and Friday. And I schedule my daily routine around my meetings. You know, my life is simple today. I don't create a lot of problems. At least I try not to. I know that, you know, I have to take responsibility for the actions, for the things that I do, and you know, this program teaches you to listen to your conscience. You know, for the longest time, I used to do a lot of wrong things when I was drinking, and I used the alcohol as an excuse. You know, oh, man, I was drunk. You know, I was high. I was stoned. You know? I can't do that anymore. You know, I have to accept the mistakes that I make and try and correct them to the best of my ability. But I've also learned through the support of my sponsor, and I was on a two-step a year plan, and again, I don't recommend that for anybody. But I finished all my steps, and John was very patient with me down in Fort Lauderdale. As I say, I have a good life today. But, you know, it's a matter of living by the principles of this program. And you can have a good life. There was a time where I would come to meetings and I would be really depressed. You drink that much alcohol, you're going to be depressed. Today, I'm much happier. Today, I enjoy my life. My son, that 8-year-old, is now going to turn 30 this August. He lives up in Nashville. And whenever we're up there, I go to meetings either in Cane Ridge or over in Brentwood. And that's the joy of this program. You get to know different people from around the country, around the world. And I feel comfortable here. You know, when I walked in tonight, you know, Megan goes, "Well, are you nervous?" I'm going, "Yeah." You know? And she's going, "I'm nervous too." I'm going, "What do you have to do? All you have to do is say, 'Here's Kent.'" You know? So, in any event, you know, I like what I do. I fortunately had the opportunity after that hospital stay. I went into private practice doing psychotherapy and was with a group of psychiatrists and psychologists in Fort Lauderdale and Boynton Beach area, and then moved up here in 2009. That son of mine came up here to go to UCF in 2002, graduated from UCF with honors. He's the love of my life. He's a great kid, and I'm just so grateful that he hasn't picked up my disease. He's married to a wonderful woman in Nashville. They both work for the Nashville Children's Theater, and so we get the opportunity of going up to Nashville quite a bit. And I look forward to doing things. You know, the depression was the past. The future, sure, there's a little bit of anxiety, but there's also excitement. There's challenge. And to be able to enjoy life clean and sober, and to be able to look forward to enjoying life. And sure, we have problems, whether it's financial issues, medical issues, relationship issues. But, you know, there are a lot of people in these rooms that'll give us the support, that'll give us the direction, that'll tell us what we need to do. You know, and I used to go to John, or now I go to Mike and John, and you know, I say, "What would you do?" You know, and they usually give me good advice. You know, I don't always follow it, but they usually give me good advice. You know, so I opened my practice here in East Orlando, and I'm as busy as I want to be. You know, life is good for me. My colleague down the hall goes, "It must be good being you." And I'm going, "Yeah, most of the time it is." But, you know, part of it is living by the principles of this program. You know, I have a set routine today. And I know what I'm doing. I don't try and put myself in stressful situations. You know, I'm cautious about people around me and are they doing the right things. And, you know, one of the things that Judge Paul told me, you know, stick with the winners. You know, and if you're here for a while, you'll know who the winners are. You know, they're working a good program. You know, they'll give you good advice. But, you know, so often it's like, you know, I've got a bit of a problem with alcohol. I'll stick around for 6 months, a year, whatever. And then you go back out drinking, and the problems come back. You know, I don't want my problems to come back. I like the way my life is today. So, you know, it just takes a little bit of time. Please get a sponsor if you don't have one. You know, it's not your best friend, it's not your banker, you know, it's somebody who, and I was always told, you get a sponsor who has a sponsor and have worked the steps themselves, okay? Men with men, women with women. Now, if there's a gay issue, you know, you got to work that out yourself.
Sure.
But whatever the situation is, straight men with straight men. Straight women with straight women, you know. There are some other things that I was going to go on, but I think I'm just going to end with this. One of the things I heard at a meeting gentleman recited a poem that had a lot of significance to me. And it was written back in 1934 by a gentleman by the name of Dale Wimbrough. It's called The Man in the Mirror. If you get what you want in your struggle for self, and the world makes you king for a day, then go to the mirror and look at yourself and see what that man has to say. For it isn't a man's father, mother, or wife whose judgment upon him must pass. The fellow whose verdict counts most in his life is the man staring back in the glass. He's the fellow to please, never mind the rest, for he's with you clear up to the end. And you've passed your most dangerous, difficult test if the man in the glass is your friend. You can fool the whole world down the pathway of years and get pats on the back as you pass. But your final reward will be heartache and tears if you've cheated the man in the glass. Thank you all very much. I've enjoyed the opportunity.